Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream on the 23rd of August 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on. Thanks for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. It's a very cold evening here in Sydney, so it's good to get by the warm computer rather than out and about at the moment. As I was saying just before I started the formal show, our dogs went on strike this evening. I took them for a walk. They came back and went straight to bed. They said it was too cold, so they got to bed. Anyway, without further ado, let me just remind you that on these particular conversations, we don't provide specific legal or financial advice. It's a general conversation. We do moderate the stream, so just be careful in the chat, but obviously encourage you to share your thoughts in the chat, and very good to have the community expressing their opinions and views. There's a little poll there tonight about what you think Super will be in 5 years' time, higher, lower, or the same, or no idea. Use that Walk the World if you'd like to ask a question to make sure that I see it in the queue. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can get your question top of the list or indeed make a contribution to what we do here. Anyway, with that introduction, before I bring Robbie in, we want to just play this very short video because it sort of sets up the super conversation rather well.
Because of our new policies, 8 out of 10 employees already get $15 a week paid into their own personal superannuation scheme by their employer. Now it doubles to $30 a week, saved for your retirement by your boss in schemes that cover ordinary workers and part-time workers for the first time. It's a savings scheme that will be good for you and good for your country. Superannuation is building a massive bank of savings for investment in Australia's export and other productive industries. Every dollar saved helps finance Australia's development without foreign debt. And our superannuation program for all workers means that when you retire, you will do so with dignity of financial security. That's the sensible direction for Australia to take.
Authorised by ARHOG for the Australian Labor Party, Canberra.
Robbie, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, that was 1990, okay? This is today, and the key question about that is, to what extent has that come true?
That's right. That was the promise of superannuation by Bob Hawke in 1990. Did it come true? It's 32 years later. And can I double check, Martin, that people can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So 32 years later, what do we know? Well, one thing we do know that didn't come true was Mr. Hawke promised that superannuation would fund Australia's economic development without the need for foreign debt. Is that true? Emphatically, no. Absolutely untrue. I think our net foreign debt position is $1.2 trillion. Our gross foreign debt position is closing in on $3 trillion, roughly similar to what we have in super, might I say. But that certainly has not funded Australia's economic development without need for foreign debt. I would argue whether what you would say it has funded is Australia's economic development, because I can tell you now, I know it's funded Sydney's toll roads, and I want to talk a bit about that, but that's not the same as nation-building economic development. So, Martin, I have a question I'd like to pose to set the scene for this. I just wrote it out. So I want people, because I don't intend to give anyone any super advice tonight, so I hope you aren't tuning in for that. I don't have any particular advice. I'm thinking macro and political policy questions, right? This is, given what you've just seen, this is what I want to pose to the viewer. Is Australia better off today with the compulsory superannuation system we have than if we had an adequate age pension, no housing bubble, and almost everyone retiring, owning their own homes and with their own savings? That's my question, because I don't think we are.
No, I think that's a very good question, Robbie, and I tend to agree. And it's interesting because Macro Business put up this today and basically said the key problem is that despite compulsory superannuation being in effect since 1992, the primary purpose of superannuation is yet to be defined. Several years ago, the coalition tried to enact a bill that would define the core purpose of superannuation as to provide income in retirement to substitute or supplement the age pension. That bill was never passed. And, of course, yesterday we had Dr. Chalmers, Jim Chalmers, Treasurer, saying we see trillions of dollars in workers' capital. We see government budgets heaving with debt. And there are obviously need for investment, particularly areas like housing and energy, Chalmers told the annual superannuation lending roundtable. And he pointed to a lack of spending in the aged care sector and said he would contemplate what, if any, further role of super there is in that. And Mr. Keating, who, of course, was there at the start, said at the same event, this is a society that can't house its own children. If super funds just think they can go buy tech stocks in America and highways in Italy, they're going to run into trouble. Without being heavy-handed, there is a requirement of the funds to look at social opportunities. So talk about polarised views, right?
Well, I think Mr. Keating, in his arrogance, would never admit, but by his words there, he's effectively acknowledging that what he set up hasn't served Australia's national purpose.
Yep.
He set it up. He wrote the laws, and he also privatised the Commonwealth Bank, which could have done those things that he's just talking about we need. Because, see, we had a system once, Martin, where you had a private sector, they made profits, people got wages, they had savings, but you had a public sector. You had a pension system, you had governments that took responsibility for a lot more things, including a lot more public aged care, a public health care system, et cetera, all of which had to be funded. And one of the ways the government funded these things is they had a national bank like the Commonwealth Bank to do long-term investment in infrastructure, and the Commonwealth Development Bank in industries. They also made the private banks park a large percentage of their capital in government bonds as part of the regulation of those banks. So there was always funding for the government to do the things that it needed to do to make sure that those needs were met. And we didn't have governments hand-wringing saying, oh, we don't have enough, we are a society that can't house our children. Paul Keating was the architect, and I'm not a hater of Paul Keating, but I'm dead set opposed to what he did to Australia economically. He was the architect of these sweeping changes, and he laid out a vision. Remember how well-spoken Paul Keating was when he laid out his vision for Australia, and I mean, so well spoken, he puts, you know, the current generation of politicians to shame. They're all like computer automatons, you know, compared to the way his turn of phrase. But he laid out this sweeping vision for Australia. This is what could be. So that he made it seem when he was dismantling what previous generations had built up, that there was going to be something much, much better. And now he said, this is a society that can't house its children. What does that mean, Paul? Right? What did you do? Now, like I said, in his arrogance, he would never admit to his faults, I'm sure. Though I do remember a few years ago when Sally McManus became the secretary of the ACTU, and she was this breath of fresh air in terms of an anti-neoliberal who denounced the previous decades of economic policy. Keating is a loyal Labor guy, and he does, I know he does a lot of work behind the scenes to contribute to the Labor Party and the union movement, et cetera. And so he was not going to criticise her. And by definition, Martin, however, she was essentially, without attacking him personally, she was essentially attacking a lot of the things he did. And so Paul Keating offered some conciliatory statement where he basically said, you know, the era of liberalism has had its day, something like that. right? And that was also a tacit acknowledgement that a lot of that promise hasn't come true. And I'm not Paul Keating. I'm just going to say it hasn't come true. And we need to be prepared to rethink the whole thing.
Yeah, and just very important point I want to make is this polarization of views between superannuation is your own money, you know, you're putting your money in, you can pull it out later at one end of the spectrum, through to a whole system to provide funding and everything else and to do things at the other end of the spectrum. And I think it's been deliberately less opaque and it's deliberately been left not clear. And I think that's a deliberate design rather than actually a mistake. That's my first point. My second point is, if you go back prior to the superannuation regime, most or quite a few employees would have had a pension scheme as part of their company employment, right? And in fact, the risks of paying out into retirement live with those firms.
Yep.
Today, the risk lives with the individuals.
Yep.
So your money is being forcefully invested by the government on your behalf into a financial system that has no certainty in terms of future outcomes. So they've outsourced all the risks to end savers. And if you put those two things together, you've got to say, this ain't working. Plus, of course, you know, Keating's point about, well, we didn't actually get it to do housing and other things. So I agree with you, Robbie. This whole thing is a con. It really has not worked anything like the way that it was meant to. I would also make the point that something like $26 billion a year in fees are actually sucked out and goes into the various intermediaries, into the various funds and everything else. So they've done very well, thank you. Right?
That's the part that is working, Mark.
Yeah, that's the part that is working, exactly. So this was set up, I think, predominantly to support the financial system and the financial players, and it also has the fundamental philosophical point about let the market, Mr. Market is, you know, king. And unfortunately, for the reasons I've said, I think it's a major problem.
I've done a lot of work on Paul Keating over the years. I think I read every Paul Keating biography there was, etc. I've got a story to tell you. There's in the 80s when he was the treasurer and the governor of the Reserve Bank was a guy named Bob Johnson. One of his biographies tells the story how Paul Keating was at the Reserve Bank meeting Bob Johnson, and they opened the window and he swept his arm out over Martin Place, and he said, "I want this to be the Wall Street of the South." He had a vision that Australia was going to be a major financial centre. Right? Now, at the time, we were still a major manufacturer. We were an major industrial economy. He wanted to replace all that and make us a major financial centre. I've got some industry friends who I enraged a few years ago by playing on our show a clip of Paul Keating talking to Kerry O'Brien. And Kerry O'Brien was questioning him about the tariff cuts that smashed our manufacturing and, you know, how Keating felt about all those people that lost their jobs in that. And Keating had the gall to say that he'd liberated them off the factory floor, right, and gave them these new jobs in the great services sector of the economy. And the thing is, I got if he's watching, I'll shout out to Paul Jindra, who's a Czech high technology engineer here in Melbourne. And that so infuriates Paul because, you know, the wealth creation that comes from advanced manufacturing jobs on the factory floor cannot be matched by your services sector. Well, you replace people who actually do something with the best paid ones in the service sector are the biggest parasites, the pinstripe bankers, right? And the other people, you know, end up running themselves ragged. There's no longer a 40-hour week. It's a 60, 80-hour, 100-hour week running themselves ragged, running a service sector job. And this is what Keating created. But he had a vision went hand in hand with his vision of Australia being a great centre of financial services, a city of London, a Wall Street, or in this book, the way it's expressed in this book, and I This is one of my Bibles of the superannuation question. Can you see that?
Yeah, unfinished business. Yep.
This is a hell of a read, this book, because the author, David Love, who used to be a Financial Review reporter, he's a real fan of Paul Keating. But he tells the story of superannuation in this book from a completely different standpoint than most people would expect. But he uses a term, instead of Wall Street of the South, he said Keating's vision for Australia was for us to be an Antipodean Venice. Because in its day, the Italian city-state of Venice was this financial empire, and it was a financial empire. It's what it was. It, thanks to Marco Polo, it set up this arbitrage trade between China and Europe with gold and silver, because the Chinese valued silver a lot more than the Europeans did. And just the arbitrage of collecting silver in Europe and taking it to China. I mean, there was a period of time there when Venice was raking in 40% profits a year as this city state. Anyway, that was centuries ago, of course, and you can document the history of how that actually extended. Like, it was people from that era that went into London and helped make the city of London what it was, the Dutch Empire what it was, etc. And all the way down to, you know, Wall Street today, it's the same unbroken line of an idea that, you know, you can be a financial, you can be the financial masters of the world, right, using the power of banking and usury and finance. But those people aren't the producers. We want once the producer nation. And so that's what, you know, I want people to be aware of that when they think about, you know, this idea of what was the intent behind super, because, you know, as a guarantee of your retirement savings, it's lousy, as you just said. If you're the poor, you know, every decade or so, some poor generation of Australians, poor bastards, are unlucky enough to retire the year of a financial crash. Right, and just when they're about to get their gold watch, their super goes down by a third or a quarter or a half or something, right? And this happens regularly. And then what if you're a woman, you know, and you do not retire on equal terms to men, but if you're on the age pension, you do, Martin. If we had an age pension, it's equal, but it's not in super terms, and it never will be. There's no. Some of this stuff is now. I noticed that Jim Chalmers was talking about that, but so it's a lousy retirement thing. I don't think it has contributed to the economic development of Australia. But what it is doing is turning us into what Keating envisaged of this major financial centre, where there's $30 billion, close to $30 billion, as you said, being made from people clipping the coupon. But then on top of that, what's the? I was going to look it up before we started tonight. People will be aware of this. There is a massive subsidy in the budget of tax breaks for superannuation on top of that, which is tens of billions of dollars, right? You know, Pete, there is a racket here. There are people who are making hay out of this, but I would argue it's not fit for purpose. So I want to read what this guy said in discussion with, this is really a book. It's not just about Paul Keating. It's about Paul Keating and Macquarie Bank. And this was the eye-opening part of this book, Paul Keating and Macquarie Bank. And let me read you a couple of quotes from it. So he's telling how great the Macquarie Bank success story is. And if you know Macquarie Bank, it's our, you know, most profitable investment bank in Australia. It's the fifth. There's the big four, and you know, Macquarie Bank's number five in size, but it's much more of an investment bank than a commercial bank, and it's a specialist in investment in things like infrastructure. And we'll talk about that more in a minute. But on page 82 of Unfinished Business, having told the story of Macquarie Bank evolving, it came to Australia in 1969, as a subsidiary of a City of London merchant bank named Hill Samuel, which you'll probably, I don't know if you have any familiarity with that bank in the City of London in its day, Martin, but so Hill Samuel was a top flight City of London firm, and Macquarie Bank became their subsidiary in 69. It was the second bank in Australia to be given a foreign banking license. Dr. John Hewson was a consultant to Macquarie Bank in 79 at the same time as he was the economics advisor to then Treasurer John Howard. And it was Hewson who advised John Howard to set up the Campbell Committee as a financial system inquiry. And that financial system inquiry made all these recommendations of financial deregulation for Australia, which when Bob Hawke and Paul Keating implemented those recommendations, it was the guys at Macquarie Bank who made out like bandits. So that part's not in the book. That's from research I've done. But this is the part that relates to superannuation. So David Love has told some of the story of Macquarie Bank developing an expertise in things like funding infrastructure. And he wrote this: Macquarie was on its way internationally. It was hardly a household name, but among those whose business it was to judge these things, Macquarie was a real comer, not only in Australia but in the world. From the Manchester bypass, Macquarie, by this time under the aegis of a newly created division called Macquarie Infrastructure Group, quickly spread its toll roads and tunnelling businesses to South Korea, Canada, Indiana, Chicago, and San Diego. Okay, so you've heard that Macquarie is spreading all over the world with its superannuation business. And then this is the next line with its infrastructure business. Paul Keating's superannuation reforms, outlined in the next chapter, would feed the Macquarie machine with the investment funds it needed to grow and prosper.
APRA released their quarterly update on the superannuation industry today, and it's worth actually just looking at a few of the statistics that came out, because the first thing to say is that superannuation overall, assets this is, decreased 4.4% during the June 2022 quarter to 3.3 trillion. And you can see there that that was a drop. Now, obviously, this is the total value outstanding, which means, of course, that the value of super has dropped. And some of you, of course, know, because the markets are down, that the superannuation has shrunk. But interestingly, the move was quite different between different types of superannuation funds. So Robbie's now gone all blurred. yes, okay, good, he's come back. Okay, good. Hello, Robbie. There you go. I'll just put you up there so you can see what's going on. So it's interesting that if you look at this, the total self-managed super fund assets rose from 864 billion to 843 billion to 868 billion, up 3% compared with last year. The APRA-regulated ones dropped down 1.1%. And the exempt public sector schemes dropped 6.2%. Now, I think that's quite interesting, because I do think that the self-managed super fund for some people is actually quite an interesting option. And in fact, somebody on the stream a little while ago said, of course, if you actually manage it yourself and then get the audit done as a sort of a separate operation, it doesn't actually cost that much. And that's what I do. I have a self-managed super fund. But it is interesting that that's actually the self-managed super fund grew and everything else didn't, right? And then if I just go on to the next slide here, interestingly, the number of self-managed super funds, which were 577,776 in June last year, went up to 603,432. So there was a 30,000 increase in self-managed super funds through the year. I think that's quite significant and interesting in terms of actually what goes on. And then they showed us that the net contribution flows were 23.4 billion. That's contributions plus net benefits, less benefit payments, right? So you see there was a bit of a spike there compared with, of course, 2020, when there was a bit of a drop because, of course, the benefits got paid out. Remember the old superannuation? You can have 10 grand here and you can have 10 grand there, right? So that's why that went up. And there was a decline of 9.5% compared to that because of the early release scheme that was going on. So the bottom line is this, Robbie. If you look at all those statistics, what you see is the value of superannuation has dropped. And in fact, the average performance levels are roughly down 6%. In fact, I'll show you this slide just to finish the story. So the rate of return for entities with more than four members was down 6% in the quarter, and for the year was down 4.2%. But then, blow me, they show you the five-year average annualized return to mask it in the way that they actually present the information. Because you don't want to show negative, do you? But, no, but folks, the fact is that, you know, on average, superannuation funds have lost money in the last few months because, of course, the markets have come down. And, of course, different funds will lose different amounts. But it is interesting how they present that in a way that I don't think is totally truthful. And I will just make the final point is the asset allocation is quite interesting insofar that there is a lot, of course, sitting in equity, both international and overseas. So 21.6% in Australian equities, 25% in listed international equities. So we're actually putting a lot of money overseas. And then, of course, we've got the cash investments and the fixed income and the very property and the infrastructure ones. And in the property, of course, Robbie, a lot of it is actually unlisted property, which is extremely illiquid and very difficult to value. So what I'm trying to say to you is that this is a bit of a cooked story in terms of actually the statistics that APRA is producing to try and convince everybody that everything's fine.
Yeah, and what... You know, I'm 48. I'm not planning on retiring for a while. But when you're saying, when you're reporting there that the returns are down 4.2% this year or negative 4.2%, that's people's retirements. They're just their expectations of what they're that they'd plan for their retirement just totally being overturned, upended, right? And there's a human toll to all that. Why is our super in American or whatever other stock markets around the world? That's what I want to know. What benefit, I mean, you know, we already know our super helps prop up our stock market, Martin, in the sense that it's a bit of a Ponzi scheme, by which I mean so much money, because super is compulsory, so much money is pushed into the market on the investor's behalf, most of whom probably wouldn't have done that left to their own devices. And I think the proof of that is I can remember in the 90s when there was this major headline that there was this one day, maybe the early 2000s or something, when the number of Australian investors passed 50% of the adult population for the first time. So the majority of Australians were now investors. And what did that mean? What did that mean? Superannuation had made us investors, right? So you're pushing all this money in the stock market, and just the amount of money that's being pushed in pushes it up. That's what a Ponzi scheme is. It's not the performance of the stock market that's attracting the money that's going up. It's the money that's being pushed into it. So now 25% of ours is going into what, the US stock market as well to help push their stock market up, right? Which you might think is great, but that can also suffer a massive crash and wipe you out in a heartbeat, right? And at the end of the day, this is a casino economy, essentially. You are forced by law to put your money into something that you're taking a chance on. And I'm still haven't reconciled myself with the fact that you can be forced by law to do that. So then you go, okay, no, I'll get a, we'll take a conservative investment position, et cetera, and you're supposed to fiddle with your superannuation settings, and the onus is put on you, and that's fine. People are getting used to that way of operating, but I still have a question. I still have a problem with that because, there's only a percentage of people in the economy that are that sophisticated that they're good at that, right? And the majority of people don't deserve to be there to be fed off by the sophisticated people just because they don't know, because they're part of a system that they're told, you know, from little things, big things grow, it's all going to be wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Take that option. And your investment future is set. And then the little voiceover comes at the end. Past performance is not an indicator of future performance. And what is that telling you? That's the real story there. Hey, there's no promise here, people. Just because the lady in the ad gets on the escalator that's going up, your money's not. There's no guarantee your money is going to. Yeah, this is a big structural issue in my view.
Yeah, and I will just show you this thing here, because this is the other interesting observation. This is actually from CanStar, and they just showed you the impact of fees in all of this situation, right? So there's two scenarios here, scenario one and scenario two. It's basically starting at 25, going on to 67 with the same income, with the same starting balance, the same investment returns, but the fees in the first one is 0.75%, the fees in the second one is 1.5%, and the difference at the end of it is effectively $165,000 different, right? And the point to make is this fee thing, which, by the way, is never fully disclosed because, of course, the fees that they quote are not the full fees, as anybody who's read the thousands of pages of stuff that everybody throws up at you will soon realize, is that this makes one of the biggest impacts of all because of the impact of fees taken out every year. In other words, you've got to actually cover those costs before anything else every year. So that is another factor. A lot of people don't get this and why the fees are so critical. But actually, the fees or the lack of fees or the structure of fees probably is one of the most significant factors in terms of actually improving or not improving the performance of the super fund.
Well, this is where I'll make a concession to Paul Keating, because he didn't just set up super, he set up industry super. Mm. And I'll say something positive about it, but then later on I want to say something very negative about it. But positive, the positive thing of industry super is that it is a lower fee structure than the superannuation funds, the one-third of super funds owned by the banks. And the banks hate industry super for being that. That's why the Liberal Party, almost everyone in the Liberal Party who attacks super, that's why they're attacking super, because they're attacking super on behalf of the banks. However, I know there's a Liberal Senator, Jared Rennick, who, you know, Jared, you've interviewed him on your show in the past. He's on the warpath against super, but not for that reason. He sees it more of the terms that I see it in, that this is all this money being forced out of people to into the casino, whereas Australia needs real economic development and investment in economic development, and the super, you know, all that capital should be being employed in a different way. So anyway, but apart from him, almost every Liberal that attacks super attacks it for that reason, because the results speak for themselves. So you and I have a mutual acquaintance, Dr. Wilson Tsai, who was a principal researcher at APRA, and Wilson was on the superannuation inquiry that took place in the just after the global financial crisis, and he did all this work for Industry Super Australia, and he showed the difference. It was even more dramatic than those figures you just showed. Then, essentially, over a 40-year lifespan, the difference just based on fees between an industry super fund and a bank super fund, just based on fees alone, the retirement difference can be $1 million over the lifespan, the 40-year lifespan of a worker's life. I mean, this it was incredible stuff, and that's the fees. And that's been the feeding frenzy for the superannuation industry, those fees. So Paul Keating worked with the ACTU to make sure that in the super system there was this part that was less profit oriented to make sure people could have that return. That's what they're advertising in those industry super from little things, big things grow ads. So that part by intent is fine. You're not having, you know, your capital taken out away from you in the form of fees, but it's still at risk in the stock market. Yes. That doesn't change that.
Yep.
Right. And you can have the best performing industry and still be there the day there's a massive crash and you go, oh, well, there you go. It's all gone.
Yeah, and then the point, I suppose, is that you know, there are a few countries around the world who have a completely different approach to it, which is effectively that money goes into effectively a government-backed thing. They use the money to invest in investment and growth and all those things, and then they guarantee payment of superannuation returns in line with what's required at the time. That's the alternative model. The model that Keating effectively put into Australia was a completely market-driven, neoliberal-driven, bet everything in the market-driven approach, right? And that means that, as I said earlier on, small individual investors or, you know, workers are market exposed.
Yep.
And that is the problem, because particularly in these days with the, you know, the volatility in the markets, it's very hard to see how many people are going to end up with sufficient super to be able to actually cover their retirement. And of course, if it doesn't work for a lot of people, it means the government's still got to pay through the pension anyway.
Well, that's right. It's that the wording that you put up there that didn't pass was a pension a replacement or supplement, because that's what happened. That is what happens anyway. You still got to pay the pension. So what if it, and the Jim Chalmers speech yesterday, Martin, he emphasised how much super saves the budget in pension payments.
Yep.
But he didn't mention the tax cuts that the superannuation sector enjoys, which is tens of billions of dollars that's not going to the budget, right?
Yep.
So if you put those two together, what the budget has to subsidise in the super system and what it's paying now for the pension, and just pay that all for the pension so that everyone has a pension that's truly adequate. I mean, truly adequate. It does cover your accommodation and your living and your living expenses, etc. Right? That, you know, seems completely out of reach for a lot of pensioners now, but a truly adequate pension, so you don't have to live on cat food. Would we be better off if you combine that with the other hypothetical scenario, we didn't have a housing bubble to go with all this insanity, so most people own their own homes and weren't renting in the first place, right? And I think, you know, that's why you got to look at the overall financial system as a whole.
Right. Let me finish this little bit of the conversation, but then I'll let you come back. Right. Finally, I want to highlight fees. Right. This is another very important slide. This shows you the relative distribution of fees across the age and balances that people have. Right. And this is the thing that nobody, I think, fully understands. If you're younger and you have a smaller balance, as a proportion of the holding of superannuation, you're paying a lot more in fees relative to those who are older with larger balances, right? You can see how that stacks up there, right?
Yep.
Now, what happens is that, in fact, everybody quotes this, which is the absolute dollar value of the fees that people pay, and say, well, the young people don't pay as much. I mean, there's still some very significant variation between the lowest and the highest. And, you know, as you go up the scale, of course, you pay more. But that isn't the way to look at it. This is the way to look at it. What proportion of your superannuation is actually being hit with fees? And, the horrible news is that smaller balances with younger people are paying relatively a whole lot more. That is another serious case of inequality, in my view. And, again, I don't think people get that.
No, and it reminds me of, like, people in finance are very clever, aren't they? They know how to find these ways, these little ways, just to push the margin in their favour all the time. In a way that the poor super account owner wouldn't even notice it, and that's why they do it. Yep. Right? It's a little mosquito prick.
And let me just say that the official fees that are quoted, right, that excludes a whole bunch of other fees, you know, trading fees and other transaction fees and things. So, in fact, if you look at the fees that they quote in the official statistics they provide to APRA, right, and if you look at the actual fees that are taken out of your personal account, they don't match. You'll be paying a lot more than the official number, right? And that's another reason why I get so cross about the whole way this has been set up, because the fees and looking at the fees and getting to understand the fees is actually a critical thing, right? And then the final thing I just want to highlight, 10.5%, right, is the current, this is from the ATO, 10.5% of their ordinary time earnings is obligated to go into superannuation at the moment. 10.5%, right? It is to rise to 12% by 2025. So we're locked into this escalator of putting more and more money into superannuation, which means that effectively we're locked into paying more and more fees to all these financial institutions that we've just touched on, right? And you know, the net bottom line is this doesn't benefit Australians. It doesn't benefit Australia, but it benefits the financial system and the financial players. And it also benefits the government because essentially they don't have to actually pony up pensions for everybody. That's why this system is a con, and that's why it's broken.
I don't think it benefits the government as much as the government says it does, because of the fact that the government still is the backstop. What it benefits is a certain philosophy of government, which is the neoliberal philosophy that we are going to minimise government, we're going to downsize government, etc. And that's part of the philosophy that went hand in hand with the creation of the scheme in the first place. But anyway, to cut a long story short, what we've just been talking about is, as you and I have talked about many times for 4 years, we both agree that the financial system should serve the real economy and the people in the real economy.
Yep.
The financial system serves us. We're not supposed to serve it. But what we've just described is we are serving the financial system, right?
Correct.
And you can be the lowest paid worker and your super is going into a fund that's helping fund managers who are paid a lot more than you'll ever be, enjoy quite good lifestyles, however, not stress-free because they usually have great big fat mortgages as well, just bigger and fatter than yours. But, you know, their contribution to the world is managing money, right? But to what end? And so if the system itself, you're feeding it instead of it feeding you, you've got to say, well, who does this serve? And it doesn't, it's not, I don't think, like most of the modern financial system, it's actually fit for purpose. And that's the problem. So, and then what I'd like to talk about is if it's not serving the people, then what is it serving? And so we're zeroing in on it. It's serving the financial sector. But this is where, as I was interrupted before on what I was saying, reading that quote, what David Love goes through in this book is that these people around Macquarie Bank and that, and the people involved behind with Keating, saw that the way to create a financial pool in Australia, which would be the basis for a financial services industry, right? Think about that, financial services industry, to replace our actual industries would be to create this compulsory superannuation system. So Macquarie Bank, I got another quote here, just on that question. There's another version of it here. Love wrote that Keating pushed compulsory super because, quote, unless the growth in savings and therefore in financial capital continued to accelerate, Macquarie and institutions like it could not manage to sustain the momentum of their growth in their overseas operations, and Keating wanted these as a new Australian industry. Now, Keating wrote, Love interviewed Keating extensively for these books, so Keating will never tell you that he did this to help make Macquarie Bank grow. But the guy who interviewed him at length said, yeah, this is why he did it, to create this system. So let's just look. I just want to give you one example. What does it mean by helping make Macquarie Bank grow? I got a quote for you from 2003, May 2003. This might seem slightly off subject, but just bear with me. This is the quote, May 2003, quote, we can put up the tolls by whatever we like, and almost as importantly, we can start the tolls on day one by whatever we like. If motorists don't complain about it being too high, then we won't have done our job. And that was a gentleman named Dennis Eager, who was the external affairs manager for Macquarie Infrastructure Group, and he was speaking about the $2 billion M6 Midland Expressway in Britain that Macquarie Bank built with your money, Australians, that Keating set up super to give to them. And this guy, when he said this, Dennis Eager, he got sacked for saying this, not because he said it, but because the idiot was too dumb to notice that in the group of investors that he was bragging to, that they have a license to print money and charge what they like, was a journo. And the journo just happened to report him to report what he said verbatim. And of course, it was a bad look. But he wasn't blowing the whistle. He was bragging. This is how they operated. Now, there's an operation in Australia called IFM Investors. And IFM Investors, and this is where I want to have a swipe at Industry Super, Martin, IFM Investors is a partnership between Industry Super funds, so the ones that are owned by the unions and, you know, we don't charge fees, et cetera, between Industry Super funds and Macquarie Bank. And they own things like the Melbourne Airport and a lot of the toll roads, and I think the Sydney Airport's owned outright by Macquarie Bank, or at least it was used to. Maybe it's IFM Investors
it's
now.
They sold it private.
They sold it, okay. Yep. But when it was privatised to Macquarie, right, and they had it for years. I remember quite a few years ago now, I went to the airport to hire, got off the plane, went to get my hire car, and the woman who was giving me the hire car said, "Oh, do you really want to get it here? Wouldn't you like to pick it up in the city?" I said, "No, I need it here." Because she said, "No, there's a train. You can go to the catch the train, go to the city." I said, "I need it here." She said, "It's just that if you get it here, you pay 20% extra, because there's a 20% charge on everything at the airport just to pay Macquarie Bank." anyway, so they made hay for a long time. But IFM Investors is this operation. Now think about this: you got the money of blue collar workers that are going into these industry super funds, helped guided there by their unions, that IFM Investors are using in partnership with this quite rapacious private investment bank to do what? To go and buy up privatised assets, whack fees on them that you shouldn't have to not ordinarily pay, right? If they're in public hands, you wouldn't. Dan Andrews has gone on a private, he campaigned against privatisation to get elected in Victoria because he's Labor and everything is on the nose. He's been on a privatisation spree since he's been the premier, including ports and the latest one is Vic Roads. They're privatising Vic Roads. But what's driving the privatisation spree? These super funds need to buy assets. And so the logic is you, the consumer today, live in a society where most things have got privatised. When they're privatised, you're whacked with massive fees. And you have to pay those fees. You can't get away from it. But the consolation you're told is, don't worry, the fees you're paying now goes into your super fund for you to live off when you retire, because you own the thing that's charging you the fees through your super funds, except it's not a choice you made. And when I think about that model, old Labor guys, right, the people who battled bankers to create institutions like the Commonwealth Bank so that public money could be invested in the infrastructure that Australia needed, and they built Australia, right? And the private bankers would never have done it. They made sure it got done. Those guys would be rolling over in their graves at what modern Labor and the unions have done, starting with Keating, selling out to the system that superannuation personifies. And, you know, I'm not, you and I aren't going to change it with this conversation, but this is one area that's similar to many other things, which I, on this, you know, we're on this, me and my party, the Citizens Party, we're on the warpath against neoliberalism, and we have one great argument on our side, which is I want everyone to stop and think. We remember the promises in the 80s. Look where it got us. Have they come true? Right, this was supposed to be a brave new world, and what do we have instead? Massive debt, massive living costs, high inflation, out of control banks, weak regulators, hundreds of thousands of financial victims that they refuse to compensate, and they're just left with their lives ruined, and no industries anymore to speak of, or compared to what we had. Of course, we've still got some, but, you know, the nub of our manufacturing industry, it's all been dismantled. And what we've got in its place is a property bubble and the single biggest sector of our economy is the financial services sector. That is the single biggest sector of our economy now, except it's a parasite on the rest of the economy, right? And you can get you can dig into the details all you like and say, oh, this is a better option than that. And that might all be true. But for the national interest, this is not a better system.
Right. And that's where the intersection between the superannuation sector and the mortgage sector comes in, right? Because the two legs of the stool, or the two arms or legs of the parasite, are superannuation and the mortgage sector.
Yep.
It's part of the same DNA.
Yeah, well, because part of it is now Keating was out of the picture for what has become the mortgage sector, so I'm not going to blame him anymore, but it was still the government consciously took the decision to create a bubble, the government in the form of the governments, the Howard and Costello government. I mean, there's three decisions in 3 years created our property bubble. The Reserve Bank taking the price of land off the CPI, 98. Peter Costello's 50% discount on capital gains tax in 99, and John Howard's first homeowner's grant in the year 2000. And those three, when they all joined, all taken together, when they crossed the streams, what happened? Massive flood of money into the housing market. And I remember from 2000 to 2004, just this incredible rise. I'm not sure it's been matched. If it has been matched since, it was been matched in the last 2 years. The massive price rise in the last 2 years of COVID extraordinarily probably might have matched it. But what really made me laugh back in those days, Martin, is when people started to notice the massive increase in the value in the price of housing, and this was all being debated, and then everyone's saying, oh, it's because there's a shortage of housing. It's because there's a shortage of housing. And I'm thinking, I've never seen so much construction in my life. This is, I'm in Melbourne. Everything was a construction zone. And I'm supposed to believe there's a shortage of housing. I lived here long enough, hadn't seen anything like it in terms of construction, never seen more homes being built, and where they were gaslighting us, right? What they did, though, what was the motive of government? It's the wealth effect. Push the prices of housing up, encourage people to borrow against the equity in their homes. Commonwealth Bank was running those ads nonstop with Greg Chappell, equity mate,
yep.
Right? I remember just before the global financial crisis, because we were warning this is going to come crashing down, and I remember this fascinating statistic came out of the United States in the George W. Bush economy, that something like one third of the entire increase in consumer spending in the George W. Bush presidency years was people borrowing against the equity in their homes before that housing bubble crashed, right? And of course, that spending drives economic activity, and the logic for the governments is it's all ideological, because the governments believe that, and a generation of politicians brainwashed into neoliberalism believes that you cannot have government officials making decisions for the economy. That's central planning. That will never work. The market, the hidden hand of the market, is what will make the decisions for the economy. And so the hidden hand of the market is the cumulative spending of the consumers. And they're getting their money from being able to tap into equity in their homes that are being driven up by a frenzy of speculation by the banks pouring money into those homes. And those decisions are going on, that decision making is going on luxury items and flat screen TVs and all this kind of stuff, right? And somehow that approach to running an economy is better and more superior than the guys in Australia in the 1940s who sat down and worked out the Snowy Mountain scheme and said, we can take this mountain range and we can turn it into a source of water and hydroelectricity to create a food bowl for Australia. Now, that's central planning. That's bad, even though our economy exists thanks to that now. Not what you want is an unbridled market fueled by the banks creating a speculative bubble, and let that decide the direction of our economy. And we've ended up where we are.
Yep.
Right. So we've got everyone exposed to both super and housing, terrified of a crash of both, knowing that a crash of both could be on the cards. And if it happens, there's nothing left.
Yep. And just to extend Mr. Market's influence just slightly further, right, there are two other areas to think about. The whole gas question, and you know, the fact that our energy sector is fundamentally linked to the international price of gas because of the way that that's been set up, with 95% of it offshore, and of course we've only got 2 months' supply of fuel, right? So if, you know, if something goes wrong internationally, we run out of fuel because we don't have enough capacity onshore. So again, by leaving all of these things to Mr. Market to sort out, right, it's the biggest mess that you could create, yeah, because effectively it doesn't work. That's the problem. It doesn't work.
Well, as a wise man once said, the hidden hand of the free market is the hand of the pickpocket that steals your wallet. That's the truth of the hidden hand of the free market. Yes. And it comes back, this reminds me of what Jim Chalmers and Paul Keating discussed yesterday, because I want to, I'm mostly suspicious because of their track record, but I will say this. I was listening to Angus Taylor today respond to this superannuation proposal. And I think I saw someone on the chat here making a comment in passing that was feeding off what Angus Taylor was said, which is this idea that, you shouldn't tell, that there should be no government direction of what super should be used for. Because Pete Keating's basically acknowledging, when he said what he said, right, I don't know if you can bring that quote back, but when he said, you know, we have a society that can't house its children. And then he also made a comment about, you know, instead of investing money in Italian roads, I think he said Italian roads, because there you go, the last paragraph. This is a society that can't house its own children. If super funds just think they can go buy tech stocks in America and highways in Italy, they're going to run into trouble. Now, he's saying there's a requirement of funds to look at social opportunities. Angus Taylor went on this typical neoliberal knee-jerk reaction to that whole thing, saying, no, 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 there's only one requirement of super funds, and that's to maximize the return of their investors. Well, then just go put it all in the stock market then. Let's not have it doing anything productive for Australia. Let's let them invest in the most toxic derivatives there are, because they have the best returns. I mean, that's a stupid argument. But what it tells me, some of these guys like still in the Liberal Party are so neoliberal, they get a sniff when Labor is even talking about, look, there's a $3 trillion pool here. We need all this investment in Australia. What can we do? Now, you don't have to make it compulsory. What you can do is set up institutions to attract those funds to invest in you. And that's what a national bank and a national development bank can do. You can issue bonds in those banks and say to the super funds, take your money, bring your money back from overseas, invest it here. It'll be guaranteed investment. You'll get a good return, and that money is going to be used. We, the government, will take the risk. You will get a guaranteed return. We will take the risk. But what's the government going to do with it? They will invest in, say, the high-speed rail that can open up the corridor between Melbourne and Sydney and create all sorts of opportunities that way. And when you have that kind of basic investment, then there's lots of different opportunities for the private sector that what's left in the super funds can come along and invest in that as well. But you've got to create the basic spine, the basic platform for that. And that's what the governments do best, because it's the long-term stuff that the private sector can't do and never would do. You could invest in, you know, an inland rail from Melbourne to Darwin. I know there's one they're building to Brisbane that maybe they probably should be building to Gladstone. A guy named Max took me around Brisbane recently and showed me how they're, instead of ending in Brisbane, it should be going to Gladstone. And that's probably true. But, you know, I worked with this great engineer who had designed one from Melbourne to Dubbo to Goondiwindi to up to Mount Isa to Darwin, 24 hours there, high-speed rail. You could get what you do is you destroy the tyranny of distance, and by having that infrastructure there, all that productive land on either side of the railway can suddenly, you can justify the expense on things like trickle irrigation, et cetera. And you can grow horticultural projects, and by getting it to Darwin really fast and connected to high-speed shipping, you can have it to the biggest markets in Asia within a couple of days and increasing our capacity to feed the world and earning a massive income for Australia. but the initial infrastructure would only ever be provided by the government to do that, right? And then it creates the proper opportunities where there is lots of investment opportunities on top of that. That's what you could do if you had a national development bank and let the super funds, invite the super funds to help capitalize it. That's what we could be doing with the superannuation investment. So it doesn't, it's not, you know, you don't have to make it necessarily compulsory, but get, but you'll have the same neoliberals turn around and attack that because it's a government role. We'll get stuffed. That's not how the real world works. That's not how we got here. That's not how America developed. That's not how Britain developed. That's not how Europe developed. They developed because governments with people with vision took these decisions. That's how we got here. And I'm sick of having these arguments with people who are brainwashing the economics the last 30 years and just like pushing a button, oh, you can't let, you can't trust the government to do that. That's not how the real world works. And maybe if you're a moron, you shouldn't be in the government, but I know like there's lots of good people that can be recruited to be in the government to help do that. And I'll give you an example of someone, of a good person who was in government until recently, and her name was Christine Holgate, and she's a goddamn genius. And she worked in a government role and she was doing a brilliant job at Australia Post. And governments can attract those kind of people. Dr. JJC Bradfield was one of the greatest geniuses in history who built the snow, the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Who did he go and work for? He went and worked for the government. He didn't go and work for some private firm. He went and worked for the government because he wanted to build a nation. That's what governments used to be. This neoliberal ideology that came in the 70s, Martin, is infantile garbage. They recruited a bunch of kids who read Ayn Rand as teenagers and thought, well, she's saying I can be selfish for the rest of my life and I'm going to be. And they went and became Liberal prime ministers, right? It's, you get out of that kind of thinking. Our nation's at stake here. Cut the ideology. What works? And what works is you need big projects and governments can build it. We've got $3 trillion in super. Let's attract it into that by setting up the institutions like a national bank.
And Robbie, the critical point here is it comes back to two fundamental questions. One, what is society for, right? And second, what are the real benefits that can be created if we think about it differently, right? Because the last 30 years has not been successful, right? We have not actually built Australia into a greater society, a greater, better performing country than it was, right? We've actually gone backwards on so many fronts.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. So the neoliberal, you know, philosophical platform that's been dictatorially imposed from Treasury as well as from both sides of major politics has failed, right? And the question I've got, I guess, is you know, is there enough appetite now within the political environment to start thinking differently? Because that's what it requires. It requires waking up out of our neoliberal dream and say, it's not working. We need to find a different way, right? That's and that's the real question now, because it comes back to, so what is this all about? What are we trying to do here, right? It isn't just about making more money for the 1% or the 10%, which is, of course, what the neoliberal philosophy leads to, right? Because effectively wealth rises to the small proportion of people. Everybody else is just pedaling away faster and faster and faster to feed the beast. That is actually the model that we have at the moment. But there's a different model, a different model where effectively what we're doing is we're actually building a country, you know, with real infrastructure and real businesses. And that is a very different mode of operation. And I suppose I get asked the question, you know, is there any chance of being able to table some of that into our political environment currently?
Well, we have to, I think we, the people, have to make that happen. One of the reasons I get a bit fired up, and I'm fired up tonight, is because of this thing I saw with Angus Taylor today. And it was, the guy could have been talking in the 80s. Mm. And there's no acknowledgement that everything, the ideology behind everything he said has led us into an absolute mess. Yep. Now, there may be, you know, look, just the language Jim Chalmers is prepared to use may be, you know, green shoots of something. And so, what the Liberals would do instinctively, and Labor would probably do if she was on the other foot, what they do is they're there to oppose, not out of principle, just oppose. They're the opposition, and Liberals are better at opposition, at opposing, than Labor is. Actually, Labor can be quite soft half the time. Liberals are masters at this. Remember Tony Abbott. So they will say what anything along this line, they're going to run a scare campaign to gaslight the Australian people, say, oh, you know, be afraid of what the government may do with your money. And I can understand people falling for that scare campaign because it's going to be an effective one. And there's nothing in Labor to give people confidence. The issue is not that. The issue is we, the people, have to be able to step back and say, look at this long span of history and go, no, that we have to forget the capacity and the ideologies of the current players in government. We have to understand government is an institution that has to play an important role, and we've got to get out of that old way of thinking. So we, the Citizens Party, who are completely oriented around, we understand the history, have done more work than everybody else, we are putting up policies to actually achieve that. Now, we got our work cut out for us because despite the public moving away from these things, the two major parties don't want to. And it's even worse in the UK. You might follow this a little bit, being a good old POM. But, you know, in the UK, they do these regular opinion polls, yep. Martin. 70% on average of the people in the UK want to renationalise everything. They want to undo everything Margaret Thatcher did, everything. Take it all back, right? Rail, water, sewage, the whole thing, right? It's a mess. They're running, the water system is stuffed, and Thames Water is making tens of billions of dollars every year, and they've got, you know, raw sewage in the water and all this kind of stuff, right? Nationalize it. This is a scam. All the railways are subsidized. The Germans are running, the bloody cheeky Germans are running these ads saying, thank you, English people, for letting us, our government, own your railways, because the profit our government makes from owning your railways, because your government doesn't believe your government should own your railways, is helping subsidize our railways.
Yep.
You know, but the public absolutely want it. Apart from Jeremy Corbyn, when he was opposition leader, nobody in the two major parties is dare to touch it, dares to touch it. Now, that doesn't make sense. We're in a democracy. 70% is huge. Why? Because the vested interests are so strong. And the same here. Campbell Newman and Anastasia and Anna Bligh tried to compete with each other as to who could lose the most seats in the Queensland Parliament by pushing privatisation. Those votes in those two consecutive elections in Queensland were extraordinary. The Queensland public voted on privatisation and they voted no, massively no, right? Big time. But like I was just complaining about, everyone, the public in Australia has turned against it because they've seen the results of that. It's been a disaster. But the two major parties don't want to change it. And Dan Andrews has come in, he just lied his head off to campaign against privatisation and turn around so much. And the pernicious thing is using the money of workers who are the people who should be the most opposed to privatisation. So these people are devious. That's why I'm saying we've got our work cut out for us. But we need to harness the power of the public. Now, my experience in Parliament is when I say these people are devious, the party machines and what exists behind that is especially devious. The average member of Parliament isn't. They're just quite powerless and they feel quite powerless, right? They don't have a clue. And now we know not only do they feel, we could probably talk about this, but not only do they feel quite powerless, even people in cabinet cannot know that they have no power at all. Yes. Thanks to what Scott Morrison actually did. So what we're saying is, okay, how do we get this back incrementally, right? And we've identified this one policy need, which is, you got the banks shutting down branches like crazy. They're trying to get rid of cash and all those sort of things. Whole sectors of society being cut off from face-to-face banking services, regional communities, elderly, disabled, and whatever. You've got the carnage at Australia Post because of what happened to Christine Holgate. And the combination of all that made us settle on the idea, well, hang on, there is a win-win solution here. If we can get to guarantee banking services to the most communities in Australia, well, let's use the post office because Australia Post has the biggest, retail footprint in the country. And it is the biggest. I'll give you an example of what I mean by the biggest. There's 1,000 McDonald's restaurants in Australia, and they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. There's 600 KFCs. There's 1,100 Woolworths stores. There's 2,000 Coles stores. That's the biggest supermarket chain in Australia, Coles. There's 4,300 post offices, right? It is a very serious retail footprint. And if you combine postal services with banking services, you guarantee the service for every community. Everyone can have face-to-face banking service. You force the big four banks to compete, which would be the only real competition they'd actually have, frankly. You can restore lending to local communities, which is very important because it's been taken away from them. You would attract a lot of deposits and a lot of customers, like other postal banks around the world have. And some of that money can also be used for to lend to state, federal, and local governments for by buying bonds or whatever, or invest in a dedicated national investment bank, infrastructure bank for investment, for infrastructure investment, right? You could create a place in the financial system that once again exists to serve the people and show how it does serve the people retailing through the post offices. That's what you could do. It's an immensely popular idea to anyone who hears it. We get to lay it out to them. We've got all the post offices support us. The licensed post office in Australia, they absolutely support us. We're in discussion with small business groups. The towns that are losing their banks support us. They're passing resolutions to support this proposal, et cetera. Individually, half the political parties in Parliament support it, the smaller ones. A lot of the individuals in the bigger parties support it, right? And this is not just a quaint idea that would do all these things service-wise. We see this as the fight back against neoliberalism. We're starting to set up the institutions again that can serve the people, right? Because government is not this entity that's separate to the people. Government is the people if the people make sure that they control the government by staying engaged in the process. And that's, I think, how you start to bring it back. It's going to be a political fight, but a political fight around specific initiatives like this.
Absolutely. And I think the answer is, as you say, start from one specific leverage point. And interestingly, I noticed that there was a piece of research done by Morning Consult, which is actually a global consulting company, and they looked at the proportion of people who are using branches versus other distribution mechanisms. Interestingly, in Australia, last year, the proportion who were interested in doing it by person and today is still pretty good. It's 56%, more than half of people. Right. So there's some really interesting
banks. The banks wouldn't want the public to know that figure.
No, exactly right.
They do not repeat that at all.
So there's some interesting things. And of course, the point is, of course, that in regional areas, Australia Post is the only game in town because everyone's shutting branches or redefining branches in a way that doesn't make them branches because they don't hold cash anymore or use cash. Yep. And that's another big deal. So, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. But I guess what we're trying to do here is to explain the philosophical context as to why this is so important, right? Because this isn't just about, you know, making Australia Post branches into banks, right? There is a philosophical worldview about a different way of thinking about the way society works and the way the economy works. And that's the whole point of this discussion, really.
No, it is. I mean, people can see it as just a good idea if they want, but I know our motivation is because we look at it in this this larger context that, you know, society's evolved over centuries where, you know, governments started taking a role in these areas and quite effectively so. And the high water mark was the immediate post-war years. And they use this term, you're probably familiar with it, it was called the post-war settlement. It was just basically means the consensus, the government consensus around the world. And they used language that at the time was purely innocent, but later on in the neoliberal era when I was growing up, it was demonized. So it was language like the welfare state.
Yep.
You know, Clement Attlee in England was proud of setting up the welfare state. And then that became synonymous with, you know, what, you know, with welfare bums, whatever. And that wasn't the idea. The idea was we're looking after people.
Yep.
My grandfather, my English grandfather, loved telling the story about when they set up the National Health Service, I think in 1946, they had all these doctors come back from the war and they put them to work in the National Health Service in England. His mother, my great-grandmother, because she could go and get treatment for free. She went and got her leg treated, and this had been a problem that she'd carried for 20 years because she was too poor to go and see a doctor about it, and it was fixed up in like 2 months. And she'd carried this for 20 years because she was so poor, my great-grandmother. And that's what Clement Attlee meant by the welfare state and setting up the National Health Service, right? Yep. And it was funded through public investment. And all that's been dismantled, right? So, and you can get into an argument with me and point to this little excess and that excess. Yeah, and you're not going to be wrong on the particular excesses, but they're the exceptions that prove the rule. And we've got to acknowledge that we went way too far the other way, right? We've dismantled our capacity to operate as a nation, and we've got to bring it back. And that's what you mean by the philosophical approach.
Yeah, and it fundamentally comes back to, so what is this all about? You know, and it seems to me it's about maximizing the benefit to society and to the communities and individuals and businesses, rather than actually just tilting the dial even more towards the 1% or the 10% or whatever. So, I mean, this is why I think this is a really important conversation personally. And, with my philosopher's hat on, I get frustrated when sometimes it drops down into an individual point discussion about a thing. Yeah. There's a bigger sort of, superstructural argument here about, so what is society for, right? And society isn't just about making a small number of people even richer.
No.
Right? That's the really critical, stake in the ground.
Can we agree on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want just to put this one up. This is from Jason earlier on. Jason, sorry I didn't get to you before, but I will put it up now. Because you were talking about Andrew's little what. Does anybody know if super funds are directly investing in the Melbourne Airport, rail link, Andrew government once went to the last election with, but was at 50x billion to build, and now is forecast to be over 100 billion, be as quick as Skybus. And so there's a big philosophical question there, which I don't know the answer to. I don't know whether you do, Robbie, but that might be an example of a program that isn't necessarily designed on the right basis, perhaps.
Well, Melbourne Airport, isn't it? I think Melbourne Airport's the only major city in the world without a rail link.
Yep.
So the rail link is necessary. I do, even though the Sydney one is expensive, I must say, being able to get off the plane from Melbourne and just go straight down on the railway and get into the CBD is quite useful.
Mm.
But it's infrastructure. I actually don't know the answer to your question, Jason. You can look it up. There's a good chance they may have some kind of role. However, it's the investment banking approach, not the national banking approach, right? So this is when the government employs people and consultants to put their investment banker hats on. Oh, let's structure an infrastructure project so that all these investors can make a mozza.
PPP, right?
Exactly. Public-private PPP, that's what it is. And it's they make massive, like when I was on my rant about Macquarie Bank before, I can remember before 2008 when Macquarie Bank and Babcock and Brown, remember that one?
Yes, Mark, I do.
They were racing each other to see who could have the biggest return on investment. And this is as banks. And it was they were approaching something like 40% return on equity in those years just before 2008. And what happened? 2008 happened, and Babcock and Brown bit the dust, and Macquarie Bank would have bit the dust if the government hadn't have scrambled to help save them.
Yep.
Right. And irony of ironies, Macquarie Bank throughout its whole history has been one of the banks that has funded the neoliberal think tanks like the Centre for Independent Studies that have promoted the neoliberal ideology. Right. But when their butt was in the crack, I had a dinner in Sydney a few years ago, and a Macquarie banker was there the night that the bosses said, quick, everyone call everyone in Canberra. We need them to save us, right? This was 2008. So I didn't mind government. He said, I never thought I'd see Macquarie Bank in favour of government intervention, but when it mattered for them, they were. That's how they approach it. And I got no confidence that in Victoria they won't be doing this the same way. The projects, the rail projects, I think are important. They Ask if you've been to London, ask yourself, when you look at that incredible subway system, without which you couldn't, London couldn't work without its subway system, right? Who had the vision and how did the investment work to create that subway system? It would have been incredibly expensive, right? Just as proportionally expensive as anything we're talking about now. And we've got Matthew, this is I'll jump sides now, Matthew Guy running ads on TV, the opposition leader here in Victoria, saying the $35 billion that Dan Andrews is going to spend on the railway loop, linking all the spokes of the railway system. We're not going to spend a cent of that. I'm going to spend it all on the healthcare system fixing it up, which is great because it's a mess. The healthcare system's a mess. But this is a guy whose hero, Jeff Kennett, 20 years ago, dismantled that whole healthcare system. And until Matthew Guy gets up and denounces and disavows anything to do with what Jeff Kennett represented, I don't believe a word he's saying. He's just using a cynical ploy. You need to have – governments need to think about how their sister's cities are going to work. But if the government does – just do the project. Stephen Mayne of the Mayne Report, who founded Crikey, the Crikey News Service, he's a Melbourne-based journo. When they opened the CityLink system here, which was our first big toll road in Melbourne, he just showed the figures that the end cost for Transurban was something like $5 billion as a total project. If the Victorian government, if the Kennett government had have just borrowed the money and built it themselves, the total cost would have been $1.6 billion. The money would have been paid back in 20 years. Transurban got a 50-year concession to charge us tolls on that.
Yep.
And I don't know if Sydney was similar to this, but you know when they opened it, if you used CityLink mistakenly and didn't have a transponder to pay the tolls and didn't go and pay straight away, you got a $100 fine from CityLink.
Yep.
And there was a big hue and cry, and they eventually just said, okay, we'll send you the bill plus a bit of an administration fee. So it was like $10, $12. But that's what they tried to do, just rig everything in their favour. And you in Sydney are the most tolled city in the world. Apparently Brisbane's is coming very close to overtaking you soon. But listen to the truckers when they complain about how much it costs them to drive across Sydney on toll roads, which have these 50-year concessions from the state government to Macquarie Investment Group and or whoever they've sold it to now. Whereas if the governments have just built the project in the first place, borrowed the money to do it from their own bank or whoever, they'd haven't paid off by now, and it could be much cheaper to operate in places like Sydney and Melbourne.
Right, and the key point there is if you actually have got any of those PPPs or other entities in place, right, they have to take 10%, 15% off the top in terms of profit.
Yep.
Right? So everything is going to cost more.
Everything.
Right? Everything is going to cost more. and that's what I don't understand that people see, right? Because the fact is that if you are actually not doing it to make a profit, but if you're doing it at the minimum effective cost to get it done, right, and you're using public money to do it, then the whole cost base and the whole cost structure will be lower.
And Martin, that's the point, because what that means is instead of you being told that, oh, if you're an investor in Macquarie Bank, you can get some of that value for yourself. The other model, everyone shares in the value because it stays in the community in the form of the lower cost of using the asset.
Yep.
And the flow on effects from that.
Correct.
Right? Everything's cheaper. So the efficiency of the pro, because these are good projects in terms of the actual infrastructure. I got to use the tunnel that allows you to get across from all across Sydney now without going through the city and the whatever it's called, that really long one at Christmas time. It's fantastic. That is so efficient to travel across there, but the efficiency gets detracted from by the price of using the damn infrastructure, especially if you're in the industrial, if you're in an industry, right? If you're a truck and you got to pay these massive fees because you're using the road so much. Didn't affect someone like me as much. So the efficiency is taken away. The productivity gain is detracted from for the cost. Let's turn it up, on its head. There's no need for this. You, the consumer, you, the person who wants to, who's worried about your savings at the end of the day, imagine if you had, you know, you had your proper adequate pension and savings and the opportunity to invest your savings in the government bonds, the infrastructure bonds that are guaranteed, that where the return's guaranteed to you, but your money is building the infrastructure that makes the economy work.
Yep. And, you know, it boils back to some very simple principles, right? So the whole point about this whole, you know, discussion tonight is to say there are some fundamental questions here about the way things can work, and there are alternative models that can work better, right? And if you take off the neoliberal, you know, sunny spectacles, right, and see things the way they really are, then there are better alternatives, and alternatives to do things more effectively for the benefit of the community. And that's what we have to do. If we're going to actually make Australia, you know, into the potential that it has, and if we actually lay a foundation for a better future, then these are some of the things we've got to explore. And that's why this conversation is important. That's why what you're doing with the you know, the public bank discussion is pretty important. And I will just turn it on its head and go back to Morrison and the grasp for power, because the other story, of course, is that if you let the neoliberal philosophy continue to drive into everything, actually you get power concentration and you get lack of transparency, and you get all the behaviours that we now see coming out in terms of controlling and manipulating, all those things. It is part of the same philosophy.
Well, what you do get is you get a breakdown in the way the economy should actually work, so that only works for the corporate elite, for want of a better word. The corporate elite have all the power and influence, and so they control the political, the parties of government, if you will. But people in government are feeling the rage from the public. This is that they know there's a, you know, we're supposedly democratic systems. They know there's a problem to be addressed, but the people at the leadership of the parties, like the Scott Morrisons of this world, they're only at the leadership because they've done the bidding of the corporate elite.
Yep.
Right? And that creates the siege mentality where we, in order to maintain power, we've got to cling to it tightly. We've got to hold it closely. You know, he didn't even trust his own colleagues, right? Thinking, you know, and of course, there's a certain crisis environment in which it happened, but that was only enough to give him the idea. the latter stuff he was doing had nothing to do with the COVID crisis. Clearly, what he became is a control freak, grasping for power. And Elisa and I did our show. We called it, as you, I think you saw it, Morrison's Mussolini moment.
Yes.
Because she's been doing all this history research into the Mussolini era in Italy and the austerity program in the 20s that Mussolini oversaw. And one of the hallmarks of his government was he was a control freak as well, and he insisted on having about half the ministries himself, like Morrison ended up doing. People can go watch the show on our channel if they want and see the details on that. But as I said to you before, Martin, and I want the viewer to think about this: what if, through some miracle, and it wouldn't have been much of a miracle, because what's his name? Albanese's margin isn't very big. He's only got a 2-seat majority or something. What if Morrison hadn't lost the election? If he hadn't lost the election, he would have all these ministries in his hands now, and nobody would know. And then under those circumstances, if a crisis hits, that he is in this position where he doesn't have to consult his colleagues, and he can just do what he wants to do, he would have unbridled power to do it. And that is not a democracy. That is how a fascist state starts, because it always starts with a crisis,
yep,
right? And what power grab happens? He's already got the power grab. He could sack half his cabinet and still have a full cabinet, because he was half the cabinet. And by the way, the portfolios he grabbed were the most powerful They're the most powerful ministries in the government. And by his own admission, as we report on our show, they were the portfolios where the powers of the minister quite extensive under what's called delegated legislation, which means when they write a bill like they were going to do with the cash ban, so they said we're going to ban cash over $10,000, transactions over $10,000 under these circumstances. The details are going to be contained in an addition to this bill called the regulations, which the minister can decide. Remember that with the cash ban?
Yep.
And so the minister had all these powers that it was up to him to decide. Now, those were disallowable, which means if he decided something Parliament didn't like, someone in the Senate could have moved a motion to disallow what he said and had 15 days to do that. In COVID, there had already been a certain percentage of laws that had delegated legislation where some of the minister's decisions were not disallowable. In COVID, that jumped up massively.
Yep.
And suddenly all these ministers were being given delegated powers that had the effect of legislation that was purely to their discretion. That's why they call them godlike powers, and they weren't disallowable. And those are the ministries that Morrison took control of. Right? Yep. So he's the most benign, wonderful person in the world, and he was truly the guy we should all have our confidence in to do this to keep us safe. Well, I saw the way he treated Christine Holger. I don't think that's about him at all. He's the guy who voted 26 times against the Banking Royal Commission and was still and has covered for them ever since. Right? This I've never seen a bigger stooge for the banks in Parliament than Scott Morrison. This guy is a toady of the corporate elite. And he's the one who was grabbing power, and I don't trust it for a second. I think it does deserve to go to an inquiry. And I think Sarah Hanson-Young, Senator, the Green Senator, Sarah Hanson-Young is right to call to announce yesterday that she's going to reopen the Australia Post inquiry, because extraordinarily, when he ordered her out of Australia, Christine Holgate out of Australia Post. No one knew at the time that he was also the secret finance minister when he did it, and that's significant for a number of reasons. One is the finance minister was one of the two shareholder ministers of Australia Post. The real finance minister, Simon Birmingham, was brand new in that position. The previous finance minister had been Matthias Cormann, and Matthias Cormann did not even know that Morrison had done this, but Matthias Cormann wouldn't have been an easy pushover. Right, he'd been the longest-serving finance minister in Australian history, but he had a brand new finance minister, and he was barking orders about Christine Holgate. And then his demand that she stand aside, which was an unlawful demand to start with, the excuse was so that there can be an independent inquiry into her buying the watches. But who was going to conduct the independent inquiry? The finance department. Of which he was the minister. So there's no way there was ever going to be an independent inquiry. The so-called independent inquiry into the watches was not independent. And so Sarah Hanson-Young is right to open that, because we've been saying all year, Martin, that we did have this Australia Post inquiry last year into Christine Holgate. Remember, your show was one of the shows that you got me on here to talk about the case back in 2020, because very few people were paying attention to it. Mm. And your show and your viewers became very instrumental in helping get that inquiry up, especially that one morning you and I did an emergency show. Yes. And that melted the phones down at the finance department, and they called Angela Cramp from the LPO group and said, call off the dogs. That was the calls coming from your program that day. That was good. But we got that inquiry up, and it made a series of recommendations, which were great, but they've gone nowhere.
Mm, correct.
Now Albo's in power. His party endorsed those recommendations. I want to see this parliament do its job. Follow through on your own damn recommendations. And now this may be a catalyst to do that. So fingers crossed. We'll keep reporting on it, but the viewers should help keep an eye on that and, you know, send Sarah Hanson-Young a message telling her she's done a great job and she should definitely follow through on it, and keep being prepared to talk to politicians about this issue, Because the more people focus on the Christine Holgate thing, it's not just the personal thing between Morrison and Holgate. It's what they both represented. She was an excellent CEO of an Australian government enterprise who was doing her job, who was not ideological, who was making a huge difference. That's why the licensed post offices loved her. She took on the banks. She wanted Australia Post to become a bank, all those things. He was this guardian of the neoliberal order, right? Getting feedback from the private bankers how much they hated her and turning around and executing her on their behalf, which is essentially what happened. And in doing so, breaking all kinds of rules. And it's the sort of thing that would never have gone anywhere unless we got involved, and we did get involved and we turned the narrative around. Then because she'd moved on, because they weren't going to give her a job back, this was then going to go nowhere, but now there's a chance it can go somewhere on the back of this scandal. So we'll keep reporting it, but I want the viewer to be primed because, one way we can impact this is if people get engaged when there's, I haven't got instructions yet, but there will be instructions of things we can do to get some results on this.
Well, democracy is a great thing when you get people to actually pick up the phone and send the emails and make a fuss. It's amazing what can be done. Rob, we've come to the end of the show pretty much. I just want to tell you that in the poll, we had 338 votes, right? This is quite interesting, right? 34% thinks that in 5 years' time, superannuation will be higher than today. 34% lower, exactly the same, right?
Red or black.
21% said it's impossible to tell, and 10% says the same value. It's just worth thinking about that. So that means that, around half of the audience don't think that superannuation is going to actually be higher than it is today. In other words, they probably won't have enough to retire to. I think that's quite informative in its own right.
That poll tells you that no one in Australia has confidence in the superannuation system.
It does.
And yet that's what our retirements depend on.
Yeah.
Therein lies the problem.
Exactly. Robbie, thank you very much for your time tonight. If people want to find out more about your campaigns, where do they go?
Citizensparty.org.au. Just to make a couple of announcements quickly, on Wednesday the 7th of September at midday in Parliament House, there will be a public forum on a postal bank. And the purpose of the forum is to hold a forum where politicians and their staffers can come along and the media can come along, because we're in the information building phase of the campaign, just briefing everybody on how it would work. Bob Catter is preparing legislation as we speak to introduce for a postal bank. I've probably told people on this show in the past, but I've had some conversations with Bob Catter recently. So now there's for the old timers on this program, Martin, when I say the old timers, the people who've been with you for a long time, I want you to consider something. You've heard me talk a lot about, and Martin talk a lot about, being engaged in politics, etc. We do have a new government now. In the whole time that Martin, you and I have been doing these shows together, it was in the Liberal government, right? So there's a new government now, and things that there's going to be things that are frustratingly the same, but there's going to be different opportunities, right? So the event will be for that purpose, so that we can build the campaign around this. What you can do, the viewer, is contact your member of parliament and say you should go along to that forum. Go to that event, right? And it coming from you, they will be motivated to either go or send some staffers. That'll be quite good. The forum will be addressed by Matt Robson, the former cabinet minister from New Zealand, who's coming over. We've invited him over. And you interviewed him a few weeks ago. I interviewed him before that. Matt's party started New Zealand's Postal Bank. Now, New Zealand's Postal Bank has just been sold, but the good news is it's been sold to the New Zealand government. This was not used as an because it's under certain bad management, it started to lose its way, but this was not used as an excuse to privatise the bank. It is now going to become a full-fledged government bank, not just an Australia Post, New Zealand Post bank. That's actually a very good development, and Matt's quite positive about what that might mean for New Zealand. Now, he's going to come along and talk about that. Politicians will be there, like Bob Catter, Jared Rennick, Malcolm Roberts, Hopefully representatives from the community, the LPO group will host the meeting, etc. So that's Wednesday, 7th of September at midday. So please get on the phone to your members of parliament, say you should go to that forum, learn about a postal bank. The other thing I wanted to mention on your show, Martin, is what we announced on our show last week that we're working with Dale Webster on. Now, Dale Webster is the journalist from the news service called The Regional, who's documented regional bank branch closures. And we want to compile a list of all the bank branches in Australia that are cashless. And that means a number of things. Ones that say to you, no cash here, and ones that say you can do your banking here, but if you want to do cash, you've got to go outside and use the ATM. Because those bank branches are not branches. There's a definition of a bank branch in the APRA rules, and that is not the definition. Yet they are counted as branches. And this relates to how APRA is allowing the banks to get away with hiding the true story of the branches that's closing down. But also it relates to the war on cash. And we've got to stop letting them get away with this, right? So what we need to do is you can't really tell which ones are cashless unless the people in the neighborhood know they're cashless. So if you have a cashless bank branch in your neighborhood, get on the phone, either email info@citizensparty.org.au, or call our toll-free number, 1-800-636-432. Let us know, because we're compiling a list. We're working with Dale Webster to do that. We will present that list to the government in estimates and show them, look, you're saying these are branches and they're not. APRA are letting the banks get away with lying here. And you know, that statistic you read before of 56% want face-to-face banking services, it all feeds into that. And then it all feeds into our campaign for a postal bank. So those are two things that people can help with immediately. Get your politician to the forum on a postal bank and let us know if you know of cashless bank branches, because they're not branches.
Great, Robert. Well, thank you very much for your time and your enthusiasm on these very important issues. And we'll continue to tic-tac over the next few weeks on the same old, sure. Right?
Thanks, Martin.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a good evening. I'm just going to take you off stream and I'll just close the show. So see you. Thanks.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I hope you found that informative and interesting. I think a lot of information there was shared, hopefully good. And just to say that there will be a show again next week, and on that show it will be Damien, and he's coming on to talk about investing and specifically what's happening there with the markets. And, of course, we've seen the markets go up and now come back down again. So very important conversation next week about is this a bear market rally, and if so, what does that mean? So hope you can join us next week. I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. Thanks for all the super chats. Thanks for all the comments. And I'll look forward to seeing you again next week. In the meantime, check out the recorded shows. It'll come up daily over the next few days. There's a few interesting ones coming up, a lot going on at the moment. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.